Now playing select theaters.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lurie. Well, what do you do if you don't have health insurance and can't afford a doctor? Well, you could go to the emergency room, but there's another alternative. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. Later on, we'll open up the phone lines. First, three listener comments about yesterday's program. Yesterday, we were talking about fake news and how some of the Parkland students were depicted in the media. Here's what three listeners had to say.
This is Kevin in Tampa. The woman from Zephyr Hills certainly was off target. The fact that it really doesn't matter whether the student was there or not. But I read the story last night, and it was followed up with the teacher from the school and everybody disavowing that statement or putting the statement that Cog made into context or the facts. He was there. A teacher pulled him into the room and locked the door. After the shooting and stuff, he ran back to his house. That was about 6 p.m. That's what I read anyway last night.
My name is Kevin. I just wanted to comment on today's show. I know that there's a lot of talking heads that proclaim to be for the public and how they feel about certain topics, but I've been watching talk radio with Hannity and Bill O'Reilly, and I watch CNN, and I've been watching it for a long time. And just wanted to comment that if these people really feel compelled to make changes in the United States, why not run for office instead of causing issues within the people and our citizens? Why don't they just do something different? And I don't think they serve really a purpose to help us. I just wanted to say that out publicly. And I think we should stop fighting about topics because it just drives us into two different paths. So that's how I feel about it, and I love everybody, but I think that we need to realize that these people are not just news organizations, but these people have an agenda.
Even at St. Pete, I was just listening to the show. You were discussing David Hogg. Was he at the high school, or wasn't he? You played back the caller. I don't care if David Hogg was in the middle of North Dakota when that happened. It doesn't change the fact that we have to ban not just assault weapons. I'm saying the whole ball of wax and get rid of handguns out of the public. You keep hunting legal, okay? You sign up for it. You go through a course. It's monitored with an ankle bracelet or a wrist bracelet. It's only coded to you. You do your hunting, shoot whatever you're going to shoot. You show what you shot. You keep it, whatever, and you turn the gun in at the end of the season. I'm not against people that want to hunt, if that's your bag.
Well, there are three listener comments that came in after yesterday's program. Tomorrow, the Clearwater Free Clinic will hold an open house for the public to tour its brand-new facility located at 1218 Court Street in Clearwater. The clinic will be conducting tours from 9 a.m. to noon. For 40 years, the Clearwater Free Clinic has provided a safety net for hardworking families who earn too much to qualify for government assistance, but not enough to afford the ever-increasing costs of private health care and insurance. And we're joined now by Jeannie Shapiro, who's chief executive officer of the Clearwater Free Clinic. And Jeannie, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So the free clinic, tell us what the free clinic does for the community in Clearwater.
All right. I'd be happy. The Clearwater Free Clinic is a volunteer-driven, which makes us very, very special. We're a nonprofit and we're non-government, and we provide problem-oriented health care to the low-income uninsured residents in our community. Most of those are at or below 200% of the federal poverty guidelines.
Okay, and what's the range of services that you provide at the Free Clinic?
Well, we see patients from newborns to 65 years of age, and 65 is our cutoff because if someone is 65, they usually have Medicare. So we're there for people who have no other options. So if you have a county social service card or Medicaid, we cannot see you. Or if you have any kind of government insurance, we cannot see you. So we're here strictly to help fill those gaps of health care. So if the patient comes to the clinic, we have primary care and behavioral health services for diagnosing and counseling. We provide medication. We can provide lab work and x-rays, wellness education, and a lot of hospital-based procedures for the patients to fall within our guidelines.
So it's for the working poor. It's not for people who are in poverty who might be eligible for Medicaid. It's for the folks just above poverty.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That is correct. And a lot of our families are very hardworking. They are self-employed or currently unable to work or work at local establishments that aren't able to provide health insurance to their employees. And right now we're finding that even if an employer offers health insurance, that because their income levels are so low, they can't afford the copays.
So they come to you?
Yes.
Wow. We're talking with Jeannie Shapiro, who's Chief Executive Officer of the Clearwater Free Clinic on Court Street in downtown Clearwater. Tomorrow from 9 to noon, they'll have an open house. Jeannie, how big is that gap? How many people use your services every year?
We recorded over 14,000 patient visits last year. We have an in-house medication room. We're not a community pharmacy, so we can only provide meds for our patients, but we provided over 30,000 courses of medication last year as well.
Now that the Affordable Care Act is in, it's being phased out, but now that it's in, have you seen demand for your services go down?
No. In fact, we never experienced any sort of reduction in our patient visits. We're continuously signing up anywhere from 50 to 60 new patients every month.
Wow. So what could you tell us, and I obviously don't want to violate any patient privacy, but what kind of occupations do these people work in? When we talk about the working poor there in Clearwater, who are these folks?
Well, we have some people that have lost their jobs, and they don't have any income coming in at this time, and they don't have any health care. So they could be restaurant workers or landscapers, cashiers, dishwashers, security guards, housekeepers, family caretakers. We find that there are a lot of of our patients had to quit their jobs to take care of a family member and lost their insurance if they had it or aren't being paid and can't afford to purchase it. We also have students.
College students.
Uh-huh.
Wow. Well, tomorrow the Clearwater Free Clinic will hold an open house from 9 a.m. to noon. It's located at 1218 Court Street. So if you're seeing 14,000 people or there's 14,000 visits last year, this has got to be pretty expensive. How does the free clinic, the Clearwater Free Clinic, pay for itself?
Good question. It's because of our fabulous community partners that we have and the generous community. Bay Care Health Service provides our lab work and x-rays for us. Our volunteers, physicians, nurses, pharmacists, volunteer their time. And we have other community partners that also do in-kind donations. So our last audit, we provided $5.7 million worth of medical services on a budget of $1.4 million.
Wow. Jeannie Shapiro is here. She's the chief executive officer at the Clearwater Free Clinic. So I imagine the Clearwater Free Clinic is not an emergency room, right? Or do you offer some emergency room services?
We offer some acute care to our patients, but we are not an emergency room. We have turned into more of a chronic care facility. 70 to 73% of our patients have one or more chronic illness that needs to be monitored and medications, lab work, in order to keep them working, to keep them healthy, providing for their families. And then we do have some acute care visits, but someone can't just walk in and expect to see a doctor. Patients have to go through a qualification process. So we have hours every day for people to come in and meet with our new patient coordinator, fill out paperwork to see if they fit the criteria.
So what? How do they get in touch with you? If there's somebody who is working poor, they live in the Clearwater area, and they don't have health insurance, what's the best way to get in touch with you?
Well, we have a website. It's www.clearwaterfreeclinic.org, and all of our information is on that. We are open Monday through Thursdays from 8:30 until 6 at night. So we are closed Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Our patients do go through, as I said, a qualification procedure. And once they qualify, then they are able to make appointments and see a physician.
So tomorrow, I imagine that the two of your biggest needs are that you need volunteers who have medical training, maybe nurses and doctors, and you might need donations. Would those be two of the biggest needs you've got?
Correct. And I must say, we like to get the message out because we are a fabulous organization and we provide such comprehensive medical care to uninsured families within our upper Pinellas County. So we provide services to patients living from Tarpon Springs to Park Boulevard in Pinellas Park. So it's, although we're called the Clearwater Free Clinic, we provide services for many, many of our local communities.
And there are similar clinics like this across the country. In Pinellas County, there's the St. Pete Free Clinic, and Sarasota has a free clinic. This is something that a lot of communities have.
Yes. In Florida alone, there are over 100 free clinics. We belong to the Florida Association of Free and Charitable Clinics. Our clinic does. And we actually have more free clinics in the state of Florida than any other state.
Jeannie, now that Obamacare is being phased out by the Trump administration, what's your expectation in the coming years for the number of visits you'll have from patients?
I wish I had a crystal ball. It all depends. I don't think that there's going to be a grasp on controlling healthcare costs anytime soon. And that being said, without some options for lower health care, I see our services increasing and the need increasing, which is one of the reasons that we did move into this larger facility to accommodate the community needs.
Oh, and tell us about the new facility. Where were you before, and how is this new one different?
Well, we were located at 707 North Fort Harrison in about a 3,200 square foot building that housed all of our clinical services. And then about 5 years ago, we purchased a building next to us where we did our new patient qualifying and had some offices and started our behavior health program. It was very inconvenient having two clinics, charts going back and forth. So we had the support of a fantastic community that helped us raise the funds to move into this facility debt-free. We still have needs, but we don't have a mortgage, and that's fantastic. So now we have 11,000 square feet. We've doubled our exam room. We have specialty rooms with specialty equipment, we have transitioned to electronic medical records as well.
So tell us what's happening tomorrow.
Tomorrow is a look-see for our community to see what a resource they have in the Clearwater Free Clinic. We do look for support with volunteers. So if you are a nurse or a physician, newly retired or still working and would like to come in for a tour, we will not be signing up patients tomorrow. This is strictly a tour-based event. And we just want everybody to come in and and see where we are and what we have, and to join us in taking care of the community.
Well, the numbers of working poor people in the country are growing every day, so it's more important that we have organizations like the Free Clinic out there for people that fall through the cracks.
There's no question. In Pinellas County alone, these are numbers from 2 years ago, 34% of the people living here were 200% of the federal poverty level. And that number, if an individual makes over $24,000 a year, doesn't qualify for us. 200% of poverty is very low.
Which is shocking because, we hear about all the jobs that are being created, but many of those jobs are low paying.
That's correct. And the level does go up, I guess, for the numbers in the family, so for children and spouses, which is terrific. But 14% of Pinellas County residents are uninsured. So the need is out there. There could be more free clinics in Pinellas County, and we would still all be busy. But I just can't say how much we depend on our volunteers and our community. We don't receive any government funding or federal funding to operate. So we are able to stay open through our donated services, fundraising, and grant writing, and generous donors within our community, which is really, really amazing.
Jeannie, if people want to find out more and contact you, how can they do it? What are the best ways?
The clinic phone number I can give you is 727-447-3041. And you can reach us, like I said, on our website, which is www.clearwaterfreeclinic.org. Our numbers are also listed on that. Most people have smartphones and can access the clinic. And we do our best to accommodate everyone. Sometimes their needs are much greater than we can provide, but we do our best then to help them find another avenue of assistance.
Well, Jeannie Shapiro, congratulations on the new building. Thanks for coming on WMNF. The open house is tomorrow from 9 a.m. till noon, and the Clearwater Free Clinic is located at 1218 Court Street in Clearwater.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jeannie.
Nice talking to you.
All right, good to talk to you. Bye. Take care. Bye-bye. Jeannie Shapiro, Chief Executive Officer of the Clearwater Free Clinic. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, and if you want to comment about anything you hear about during this hour, you can always email us at dj@wmnf.org. We're going to go back and listen to some sound from a couple of things that happened last night. We're going to go to PBS and listen to some sound from the PBS NewsHour last night about that situation in Mexico with the so-called caravan heading our way, and the president saying that he wants to put U.S. military troops on the Mexico border. But first, we're going to listen to Joy-Ann Reid, who's a commentator for MSNBC. She was summing up yesterday what it meant when the president, President Trump, yesterday on Air Force One, said he knew nothing about the hush money that was paid by his attorney to Stormy Daniels, the adult actress, in some sort of an agreement between Stormy Daniels and Trump's attorney. So when President Trump said on Air Force One that he knew nothing about the agreement or why it was made, this is what Joy-Ann Reid said when that news was revealed. Let's listen in and get your comment. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Let's see if we can pick this up here. Maybe not. Let's see if we can get it here.
This claim tonight, in your view, make it more likely that you could convince a court to sit for a deposition for him?
Well, I think it does, most certainly.
All right, we're going to try to straighten this out. Let's go back and listen to Joy-Ann Reid from MSNBC last night.
Unusual statement, Air Force One. Does Donald Trump making this claim tonight, in your view, make it more likely that you could convince a court to sit for a deposition for him?
Well, I think it does, most certainly. And furthermore, Ari, you know, he's effectively thrown Michael Cohen now under the bus, at least from an ethics standpoint, with the State Bar of New York by making these statements on Air Force One. But again, you know, this is an undisciplined guy who, you know, he finally cracked. And we knew he would crack eventually. We've been patient. I've been waiting. And lo and behold, who would have thought that it would have arrived on this Thursday, this glorious afternoon here in New York?
Well, you say he cracked. You say he threw Cohen under the bus. What do you specifically mean? You're referencing the idea that if Donald Trump says, as he just did here within the hour, that Michael Cohen went rogue and did this all by himself, that actually hurts Cohen within the rules for lawyers because it makes it look like he went off and did something without authority from his client?
Well, that's exactly right, that he went off on his own, half-cocked, if you will, and negotiated this agreement, made the payment without any knowledge by Mr. Trump. I mean, that old saying, what a tangled web we weave when we practice to deceive, never has been more true than it is right now, Ari.
Well, that obviously was not Joanne Reed. That was Stormy Daniels' attorney last night on MSNBC. We'll see if we can pull up the Joanne Reed commentary from last night in just a moment. Well, let's switch gears here and listen back to a discussion last night on the PBS NewsHour, which we carry on our HD3 channel, The Source, and it's easy to listen to. You can go to just wmnf.org/listen and listen to our all news and talk channel, The Source. But let's listen to a discussion last night on the PBS NewsHour about President Trump's decision to send military troops to the U.S. border. The president is not the first modern president to do so. It happened both during the Bush administration and during the Obama administration. Let's listen to two experts from both administrations talking about what it means for the president to send troops to the border. This is from the PBS NewsHour last night.
A language app that teaches.
Okay. All right. We are going to hear this report in just a moment, so hang in there. We're going to go to the PBS NewsHour last night. John Yang is the reporter, and he's going to interview a former Bush administration official and a former Obama administration official.
As we reported earlier, the president says he wants to send thousands of National Guard forces along the U.S. border with Mexico. While Mr. Trump's plan has raised concerns, there is precedent. Both Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama sent troops to the Southern Front during their terms. We get two takes from experts involved in both of those deployments. John Sandweg worked at the Department of Homeland Security during the Obama administration, and Teresa Cardinal Brown advised the Bush administration's Department of Homeland Security.
Welcome to you both. I want to ask each of you, and start with you, Teresa, about your decisions, the decisions made under your when you were working for the administration. President George W. Bush sent 6,000 troops to the border in 2006. What were you trying to accomplish then, and what was the situation that prompted this decision, and how does it compare to today?
So at that time, there was a very large number of apprehensions happening at the border, well over a million apprehensions a year. And a lot of it was happening in Arizona basically overwhelming the ability of the Border Patrol to handle it at the time. We had bipartisan calls in Congress for sending troops to the border. We had bipartisan calls from governors along the border asking for support. DHS was in the process of ramping up additional hiring of Border Patrol. We had about 7,000 fewer agents at that time than there are now. And so this was seen as a way of assisting the Border Patrol, supporting them in their efforts, and basically freeing up Border Patrol agents from some of these collateral duties so that they could do more processing and apprehending of people at the border.
And John, in 2010, President Obama sent 12,000 troops, or National Guard, 1,200, I'm sorry, 1,200. What was the situation then, and how does it compare?
Well, similarly, we had a large number of intrusions into the United States, primarily at that time by people from Mexico. They were trying to evade capture. We also had just, Congress had just passed a bill giving us some more additional additional funds for more Border Patrol agents and more technology. So the idea was to bridge until we could get that new technology in place. So that was the thinking then at the time, and that's why we deployed the Guard at that time.
And does this decision, President Trump's decision, make sense now? I mean, picking people up has ticked up at the border, but it's still at the lowest level it's been since about the 1970s.
Border Patrol has never been better staffed, never been better equipped, and you've never had fewer activity at the border than you do right now. 300,000 apprehensions last year is the lowest in decades. As Teresa said, in 2006, they had over 1 million apprehensions with about 12,000 Border Patrol agents. Yeah. That makes sense. When you have 20,000 Border Patrol agents apprehending only 300,000 people. And let me just add one quick thing. These people are actually surrendering themselves. Roughly at least a third of these individuals are walking up to Border Patrol agents and surrendering, or not even coming across the border, but walking into the port of entry and surrendering. So the idea that we need the National Guard to somehow supplement the detection ability of the Border Patrol just seems ridiculous at this time.
Teresa, what's your take?
I agree these conditions are different. One additional factor that was going on in 2006 is that we actually did have a large number of Central Americans at that time coming in. They weren't the families, the minors and the families that are coming in now. It was mostly men, and they were trying to evade. We had issues with processing them because they couldn't be returned back across the border. So there is some similarity there. But the scale is completely different. As John mentioned, we've had a recent uptick from month to month and a large uptick from a year ago this year, but last year was the lowest on record since the 1970s. A lot of people are attributing that to the election of President Trump. Yes, it's going up, but we're nowhere near the scale we were back then.
And John, you mentioned that the deployment under President Obama was to bridge until some technology got put into place. President Trump says this is until Congress takes the action necessary to close the loopholes on undermining our border security efforts. Is that essentially open-ended and what's your thought on that?
Well, it certainly seems open-ended to me, and I think a lot of this, really, frankly, is politics. The Border Patrol, there weren't any calls or any perceived gaps. Their ability to arrest the people that are coming in, I think, is very well established. They have more than enough manpower and equipment to handle what's coming through. I think something larger in the political realm was at play with this decision.
And Teresa, what were the downsides that you worried about sending active duty military, essentially, to the U.S. border?
Well, these were National Guard troops, and so there was a lot of negotiation with the governors. There was a lot of discussion internally in the administration about would they be armed? Would they be able to do any law enforcement activity? It was pretty clear early on that they were not going to be arresting individuals at the border. They eventually were armed in certain circumstances, but not at the border. And so that was a lot of the negotiation with the governors. The other big issue is how it was all going to be paid for. National Guard troops are usually under governor's authorities, and the states would pay for it unless the federal government reimburses. Federal government did reimburse about $1.6 billion over that set of deployments. So that's going to be an issue Congress is going to have to tackle no matter what.
And Teresa, staying with you, what was the reaction, or how did the governors and how did the Pentagon react when you talked about this, raised this possibility?
The Pentagon was nervous, I think, about this idea. There were other things going on. Remember, this was not that long after 9/11. We had operations going on in Iraq and Afghanistan where active duty National Guard were created, put into active duty status and deployed overseas. We weren't that far after Katrina. National Guard was still doing a lot of cleanup in those areas. So there were a lot of other duties that people wanted the National Guard to be doing. This wasn't necessarily top of mind. That having been said, like I said, there were calls, and the governors were eager to do this because of the flow that was happening at the time. So we worked out agreements. There were 6,000 at most at any given time. Over the 2 years, about 29,000 National Guard troops on active duty circulated through those roles.
And John, what was your experience with the governors and the Pentagon?
Well, the governors were okay with the plan, and I think that, at the time it was a very politically heated time for us, and so there were some governors calling for even more troops, especially in Arizona and some of the other border Republican, governors-led states. But the Pentagon itself was reluctant to do the mission and certainly concerned about the funding and that this drained them from other priorities.
And John, quickly, did it work?
Well, we transitioned. I want to make this point very quickly, and this will be interesting to see what the president does. We went from boots in the ground to boots in the air after 1 year. And when we got the boots in the air, that meant air support, fixed wing, and helicopters. That actually was helpful to the Border Patrol and actually proved very effective. I think boots on the ground, frankly, probably weren't all that effective in hindsight, and it's not nearly as effective as the technology which is currently deployed.
And Teresa, what was your experience?
Again, it was bridging a gap as the Border Patrol was staffing up at the time. It did help with that. They did do some of the same similar kind of surveillance operations, monitoring cameras and ground sensors, and that helped with apprehensions. And so, you know, from that standpoint, it was a success. But, you know, it was wound down after 2 years, in part because the National Guard was tired. They'd been doing an awful lot of missions, not just at the border during that period of time. And Defense Department was like, yeah, we'd rather grind it down if you can afford to.
Teresa Cardinal Brown, John Sandweg, thanks so much for explaining this.
Well, that was from the PBS NewsHour last night. John Yang, the reporter, John Sandweg and Teresa Cardinal Brown, both former Department of Homeland Security officials, talked about the stationing of U.S. troops on the border with Mexico during the Obama and the Bush administrations, making the points that last year, when it came to border crossings, border crossings have been the lowest on record in the last year since the 1970s. Sandweg making the point that we have more than enough manpower now on the border. The Pentagon, he said, was reluctant the last time because of the drain on resources. And we heard Brown say that the effort wound down after 2 years, in part because the National Guard was tired. And also making the point that boots on the ground were not all that effective. So we could talk about that. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. And if you want to talk about anything that's in the news, we can do that. And if you want to talk about health care, we can continue to do that. I'm going to play this Joyanne Reed commentary last night. It's pretty short, but it kind of sums up where she thinks we are regarding the exposure of President Trump on the Stormy Daniels issue. So let's listen to what she said on MSNBC last night. Pretty succinct, pretty short, and I want to get your opinion about this. Here is Joyanne Reed from last night on MSNBC.
But let's just apply the common sense test here to what the president and Cohen want you to believe. They would have you believe that that his attorney by himself took $130,000 of his own money to pay off someone after the Access Hollywood tape that did not impact in any way Donald Trump's ability to be elected. Mm-hmm. And right before the election, give her money, although they believe her to be not credible, somebody that they have described as having zero credibility. So someone you don't believe can implicate your client, that your client says he never had a relationship with. So you just give this person that he had no relationship other than taking photos with $130,000 of your own money as the lawyer. You create an LLC to give her the money through a secret corporation. You, on your own, as the lawyer, create an alias for your client, David Dennison. You put that alias's name on the agreement, never telling your client you've created an alias, you've created a company, you've taken your own $130,000, not expecting to be paid back, and you do all of that simply because you're afraid a woman will make a claim that you believe to be completely false and not provable, so that she can't even prove she had a relationship with him. What would stop any woman off the street then to just walk up to Donald Trump and say, I too had a relationship with Donald Trump? Why weren't there hundreds of women lining up to get $130,000 in free money from Michael Cohen? The whole thing makes no sense. You don't have to have gone to law school to understand that that is crazy. We as civilians pay lawyers. We hire someone like Michael Avenatti. They don't pay for our issues. Yes. We pay them. So Donald Trump didn't pay his lawyer. His lawyer paid a random woman who all he did was take a picture with in California. This is crazy. And so I think Donald Trump's problem is, to your point, and I think to both of your point, he never should have answered the question, because the only logical answer to this, right, is of course I had my lawyer do this, and of course I meant to pay him back, which means they attempted to influence the election. Mm-hmm. There's no way out for Donald Trump here. I mean, the Mueller case on its own with the Russia stuff is tough. The Stormy Daniels case feels like an...
Well, that's where it ends. The Joyanne Reed commentating, or being a commentator last night on MSNBC, asking the big question, why did Trump's lawyer pay a random woman $113,000 if she didn't have anything to do with Donald Trump? What do you think? 813-239-9663, email address dj@wmnf.org. And we can also talk about the situation on the border with Mexico. I think President Trump And some people on conservative media are suggesting that a caravan of refugees from Honduras, which is now bivouacked somewhere in southern Mexico, that they somehow present a threat to the U.S. And so we could talk about that, too. Do you fear that caravan of refugees from Honduras and other Central American countries? Again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. Here's an unsigned email from the 813 area code that says that he or she still supports President Trump, and that President Trump's poll numbers are 51% and rising with independents. So there's somebody who is weighing in. You can weigh in, too. Jeff in Newport Richey says that the free clinic never saw a decrease under Obamacare, and Obamacare did not make health care affordable, writes 352. That's an interesting point. The guest from the free clinic was making the point that they serve the working poor. And the number of working poor people really is on the increase in the U.S. A rising number of people just live paycheck to paycheck. The United Way of this area says that about 41% of people here in the Tampa Bay area, 41% of the households, just live paycheck to paycheck. They're just the working poor. They've got something called the Alice Study. And that number grows and has really grown. The more we hire servers at restaurants and landscapers and people that work in the service industry that get paid minimum wage, we are creating more and more working poor. $8 an hour is not a living wage. It takes somewhere around $20 an hour to begin to afford everything. If you have air conditioning and you have electricity and you know you have a rent in a house that's not a slum. You know, most rents, if you've tried to rent a house or rent an apartment here in the Tampa Bay area, you know rents are in the $800, $1,000, $1,200, $2,000 range. And so that means that to rent an $800 a month apartment for one person, ideally you should have an income of $3,200 a month. Not many people do that. $3,200 a month is about $40,000 a year, and many, many people here in the Tampa Bay area earn less than that. So let's see where people want to take this. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. Toxin Blades writes that David Hogg admits he wasn't at Parkland during the shooting and isn't even a student there, and he's 20 years old. Okay, so David Hogg, that topic is coming up again, and here's somebody who signs himself as Toxin Blades. That obviously is fake news, and we played one of the original interviews with David Hogg yesterday here on WMNF. Hogg was at the school. His dad is an ex-FBI agent, and there's plenty of proof that David Hogg is a student at that school. So there's a lot of people trying to create fake news. And Toxin Blades, I'm not sure why he's sending it under the name of Toxin Blades. This person doesn't really reveal who he is. But he sends an email from a place called Big League Politics. And well, I'll just play it for a little bit. We'll play this soundbite and see if Toxin Blades... See if we can bring up the soundbite here. The video says within hours of shooting, David Hogg said he
was... Our first response was, that sounded a lot like a gunshot. And we closed the door. And we tell our teacher she closes the door. And right after she does that, the fire alarm gets pulled.
So I'm playing this email that one of our friends who thinks that David Hogg is sort of crisis actor.
I got my camera and got on my bike and rode as fast as I could 3 miles from my house to the school to get as much video and get as many interviews as I could, because I knew that this could not be another mass shooting.
All right, so that is a short soundbite, and David Hogg was saying that after he got home at 6 o'clock, he gathered his camera and drove his bike back to the school. And from that short soundbite, people are suggesting that David Hogg is some sort of crisis actor, which is ridiculous. But it shows how gullible people are, doesn't it? Toxin Blades being among the most gullible, I guess, sending that email in. We played the long interview that he did with MSNBC the morning after the shooting at Parkland yesterday morning, and I can go back and play that again. But it's clear that this guy is a student, and it's clear that there is a whole industry out there trying to denigrate these Parkland High School students. Why do you think that industry is out there? Why do you think so many people are creating so many fake videos of this incident and taking a short clip of Hogg out of context and not putting it in context, not telling you that Hogg was in the school the time of the shooting. In the afternoon, he was in the classroom. He was saved by a janitor and apparently a fellow teacher or a teacher. And he shot video of being inside the classroom as they were hunkering down, trying to avoid the gunman. And then the students were released about 3 o'clock. He went home. And then at 6 o'clock, after the all clear was sent out, he grabbed his camera at home and went back to the school on his bicycle. And we know that conservative websites, right-wing websites like InfoWars are taking snippets of David Hogg's interviews and trying to misconstrue where he was. But why do you think people are so bent on trying to denigrate the reputation of the students from Parkland? 813-239-9663 is our phone number. Email address dj@wmnf.org. And we'll take some phone calls now. And let's see if we can get these phone calls up. Here's an email before we go to the phones. Here's an email that says, $800 gets your room in a slum if you're lucky. That's Lou in Tampa. And then somebody, DeMarco, writes, there is no problem with immigration or immigrants. The only reason President Trump is willing to waste money on troops at the border and a wall is to scapegoat immigrants for the problems in the U.S. He's doing this to deflect the blame from where it belongs with the greed of the U.S. corporate sector, writes DeMarco. We're going to take these calls, 813-239-9663. Caller, what's your name and where are you calling from?
Hey, it's Jeff in Newport Richie.
Hi, Jeff. What would you like to say?
Well, you know, the thing about David Hogg, I think a lot of the problem comes in the line where he says, because I knew this could not be another mass shooting, you know, but that's not what I called about. What I called about was that third listener comment, the guy who says that after hunting season, turn your guns in. Listen, I have a concealed carry permit. I carry every day, okay? But I'm not a hunter. I couldn't, or my heart doesn't work that way. I couldn't just shoot an animal. But if I'm at the ATM and somebody comes up behind me and puts a gun to my head and says, give me your money, I'm going to turn around and blow that person away. And that's not a Second Amendment right, Rob. That's a God-given right. Your body is a temple of God, and you have the responsibility to protect it.
And, Jeff, don't we all have a right not to be shot, too? The folks, the rest of us that don't carry guns, we have a right not to be shot.
Absolutely.
So how do we protect our rights from people like you and people like the shooter in South Florida?
Rob, you don't need to be protected from me unless you're going to come up and try to rob me.
Well, I'm not going to try to rob you, but remember, this shooter in South Florida obtained his guns legally. So
No,
he did. He obtained his guns legally. So how do we protect ourselves against people like you and him who obtained guns legally?
Well, Rob, don't compare me to him. I don't go getting schooled up.
All right,
but
statistics show that if you have a gun in your household, that the people in that household are more likely to be victims of that gun than if you don't have a gun in your household. I don't have a gun in my household. I'm not likely to be a victim of a gunshot. But you, because you have a gun in your household, statistics show that somebody in your household, you or somebody else, is more likely to be a victim of that gun.
What statistic says that, Rob?
I'll pull it up. I'll pull it up.
Okay.
All right. And Jeff, you know, when Hogg says that I didn't think this was going to be another shooting, he was surprised, that he was expressing surprise, just like you and I wouldn't expect to be the victims of a massacre.
Yeah, but Rob, he didn't say I didn't think. He said because I knew this could not be another mass shooting.
Well, he was expressing surprise.
Well, you know, I'm not trying to defend or take away from what he said. I'm just saying that's where people's doubt that he was in the school when it happened.
Yeah, but he shot video. He shot video inside the school with the sounds of screaming in the background.
Yeah.
You think somebody made that video? So you think that's a Hollywood made video?
I don't know. You're saying people are making up the video where he says that he had to ride his bicycle to the school.
No, I'm not saying they made it up. I'm saying they took it out of context. They took a 3-second soundbite in which they don't reveal that he went home before he picked up his camera. So they take a 3-second video out of context. So, you know, it's different. If you watch Hogg's video, he shows people hunkering down in the school. They're deadly afraid of the shooter. That's a real video. That's not edited. But when you see a 3-second video of David Hogg saying, I was home and I picked up my camera, but that video doesn't reveal that he had gone home after the shooting, stayed at home for a few hours, picked up his camera, and when the coast was clear, he went back to the school. And that's what that 3-second soundbite doesn't tell you.
Video, and then had to go home and get his camera?
Yeah, he went home to get his camera, but
then how did he take video if he didn't have his camera with him, Rob?
No, he had a cell phone video.
Oh,
yeah. Hogg is a he works at the student TV station, and he's got a cell phone. Like, I assume you've got a cell phone, right? You've got a camera at your fingertips, and we all can take cell phone video, and we saw the cell phone video. And then he goes home and he gets a better quality camera, and he picks that up on his bike. He takes it back to the school. All right,
Rob,
Jeff.
He couldn't have gotten that video that you're saying he shot from somebody else.
I'm saying that it's really clear. His story is very simple, and the, you know, Occam's razor, right? The simplest explanation is the best explanation, and that is he shot cell phone video initially, and then later he took this other camera down. So this guy is not, you know, for people on the right to try to destroy his reputation, I think is silly.
Well, I'm not trying to destroy his reputation. I'm trying to understand, if he had his cell phone there and was taking video, why did he have to go home to get a camera to get as much interview?
Because everybody was told to go home. They were told to get out of the crime scene. Go away. Go home. They were told to go home. Anyway, Jeff, thanks a lot. We're not getting anywhere, buddy.
Thanks, Rob.
All right. Thank you, Jeff. What do you think about Jeff? 813-239-9663. Let's go to Devin in Sarasota. Hi, Devin. You're on. What would you like to say?
Hey, Rob. Thanks for the show. You do great work. You know, since Parkland, I've done a lot of research, and what these folks don't know who are concerned about gun violence is there have been so many laws adopted to protect guns owners, gun sales. Unless people get like strategic, like a laser, and go after these laws one at a time, nothing's going to change. Here's a couple examples. Did you know in 1998, Florida actually amended our constitution to require background checks and background checks. Oh, and a 3-day waiting period for every gun sale. Did you know that back in 1998 we did that?
No, I didn't know that. I mean,
well, here's the fun fact. The legislators, in their wisdom, they gave each county the option to adopt this. They gave the permission to say you can require this. So after a tragedy where 4 cops were killed and a couple civilians, every county, all the big ones, they adopted this local law. It says there will be a background check and a 3-day waiting period. You know, Hillsborough, Pinellas, Miami. Well, as it turns out, nobody ever enforced it. No local law enforcement enforced it. So then the counties rescinded that rule. it's bizarre.
Yeah. All right.
Well, it gets better. You know, the gun manufacturers cannot be sued. They're the only corporation that cannot be sued.
Yep.
Well, that's a law that could be repealed.
So you think that repealing the gun laws one by one, which would be your number one gun law that you would repeal?
Well, the gun protection law, it's that one right there. They sell a product that if it's been proven that it's either, you know, caused damage or can cause damage, that they're liable for it. It's the only manufacturer of a product in this country that actually is shielded from liability. And that was adopted by that guy Larry Craig from Idaho, and actually there is a bill right now proposed by both Blumenthal and Adam Schiff to repeal that.
All right, Devin, thanks a lot. Thanks.
You're,
all right, thanks for adding that. Jeff asked me where it has been demonstrated that having a gun in your home increases the likelihood of gun violence in your house. I would go to the Annals of Internal Medicine, January 21st, 2014. Just read the headline here. The accessibility of firearms and risk for suicide and homicide victimization among household members, a systematic review. And it just says that research suggests that access to firearms in the home increases the risk of violent death. So that's published on the Annals of Internal Medicine. You can find that easily if you do a web search. Let's go back, which proves that if you have a gun in your house, you're more likely to be a victim of gun violence. Let's go to Danny in Tampa. Danny, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hey, Rob, thanks for that. According to that statistic, I'd heard that before, too. You know, it really is hard to believe how some of these people will just go ahead and try to defame and to lie about some of these students, and all just so heads are just so they can defend their right for their guns. It really is sad and really depressing. I mean, you know, and also I'm also 100% against hunting animals too. I just think it's just a rationale to go ahead and just for people to go ahead and just blow apart animals because they feel that they're better than they are. And you know that Jimmy Kimmel's into a war now with Sean Hannity. You hear about that?
Yeah, I didn't watch the video. So what's their beef?
Well, what it was the night before he was making fun of Melania and making fun maybe of her accent because she was reading a children's book, and Hannity called him an ass clown. So last night he got on there. He says, "Well, you know," and I woke up to find out that I'm in a war with Hannity. He called me an ass clown, and he's so concerned with my rear end and everything. So if I'm the ass clown, he must be the ass circus. Because hey, why don't you talk about somebody like Donald Trump who went out there and cheated on his wife 4 months after they had their baby and cheated on them? Why don't you call him an ass clown? So they're back in it. So one thing for Donald Trump to be sure is never get into a one on one with a comedian because you're at your own risk with that.
Okay, Danny, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Let's go to Jan in Tampa. Jan, you're on WMNF. What would you like to say?
Hey, Rob, I want to respond to the guy who said he carries a gun all the time,
yeah,
that he wouldn't shoot an animal, but he would shoot somebody at an ATM.
Right.
Unbelievable. First of all, just to drill down to that one comment, he basically can only take $300 maximum out of an ATM. So he's taking somebody's life for $300. So if you would ever stop and ask those people, do you really want to do that? They would say, well, I have to shoot first before they shoot me. And then it's a ridiculous comment because by the time he reached for the gun, if the guy really was serious, he would have ran off or shot him. But the point I'm trying to make is a lot of these people that carry guns do not understand their trade-off. This guy was trading off a guy's life for $300.
Yeah.
So that's my comment.
Yeah, that's a good point. Jan, thanks a lot. Thanks for making
you.
It. 813-239-9663. Let's go to Robert in Sarasota. Hi, Robert. Thanks for calling WMNF.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me on your show, and thanks for the community service you do here at WMNF. I'm calling to comment on the David Hogg story that he's not a real student at the Parkland School. And not for 1 minute do I believe that he isn't a student there, but even if he wasn't a student there, how does that change the shooting in any way? How does it change the details of the horrific thing that happened there?
Well, you know, there's a whole industry out there that wants to make you to believe that all these mass shootings are staged by the government. All the people killed are actors, and that the government is trying to convince you to either give up your gun or allow the government to take away your gun. That's the industry that's out there. And it's been going on for 20 years. And they've been trying to convince people. Every time there's a mass shooting, they always say, oh, it's, you know, somebody who's drugged deliberately by the government, and they're forced to pick up the gun and shoot these students or shoot the people in the movie theater. So there's a mass paranoia industry out there, and they've got a lot of followers. They've got millions of followers. But you're right. I mean, how does it make a difference? The shooting occurred. It's a horrible tragedy. The guy obtained the guns legally, and what can we do to stop it? And that should be the debate.
That's the bottom line right there. Fake or not.
Yeah, fake or not.
Doesn't seem to make much difference.
Yeah. All right, Robert, thanks a lot.
Thank you for your
Thanks for your kind words, too. That was nice. Wendy writes this. I used the Clearwater Free Clinic years ago before Obamacare. They were professional, they were kind, and they made you feel comfortable, writes Wendy. Let's go to Mark in St. Pete. Hey, Mark, we just have 30 seconds. What would you like to say?
Hello?
Hi, Mark. You're on live. Thousands of people are waiting for your every word, and we only have 20 seconds.
Right. I think people are afraid of these students because they have been so effective in organizing these rallies and marches, which have also been decried as fake and organized by Hollywood liberals. I think that's why so many people are.
I saw so many Hollywood liberals in St. Petersburg at that March of 5,000 rallies. Every Hollywood star was there the other week.
They're saying Hollywood liberals.
I know. Yeah, Mark, it's a good point. Mark, I'm sorry we're out of time. If you want to comment about today's show, you can call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. And I'll play your comments back Monday morning at 11 o'clock. Now stay tuned for the king of afternoon radio. Daniel Ruth will be along with the Midpoint program. This is WMNF in Tampa.